Wales. Built right into the city wall, high above the Shropshire Union Canal, is what must be the best located bookshop in Britain. Stepping inside adds to an already slightly magical air. A bell tinkles, a young bearded owner looks up welcomingly, and a browsing girl turns with a smile from shelves groaning with out-of-print ghost stories and Arthuriana, which is what Gildas Books and proprietor Scott Lloyd specialise in. I instantly spot a copy of L.T.C. Rolt's Sleep No More, a fabulous, long-out-of-print selection of eerie stories set around canals, railways and deserted industrial locales. I lost my original on a late-night train trying to defend a single woman from a drunken businessman from Coventry. His company were called the General Asphalt Group, in case you fancy boycotting them, and I've been looking for a replacement copy ever since. And here it is, placed there by fate, at the frankly very reasonable price of £20. Make sure you have a proper look, says Scott anxiously. There's a bit of water damage and the title page is missing. Otherwise, it'd be more like £150. I pass a pleasant half hour in this quaint corner of Chester and leave with several other of Scott's recommendations under my arm. In the distance are the Welsh Hills as you turn left along the wall and head down past the Rudy, prettiest racecourse in England, to the Watergate. The Watergate, by the way, is a legacy of when Chester was a port. Not just any old port, the busiest in northern Britain, no less, taking regular deliveries of olive oil and fish sauce for the homesick Roman garrisons, pining for a change from cabbage and spuds. Then, with spectacular bad luck, it silted up, and the trade moved away to ports with actual water in them. I walk past the D and watch a man dressed as a Roman legionnaire waving an unconvincing spear at a party of kids in maroon blazers before my eyes caught by a public house. I'd heard a lot about this place as I'd chatted with Chester folk. The Albion Inn, below the city wall on the corner of Albion and Park Street, looks like a typical backstreet boozer, albeit festooned with flags and blackboards. Get down to street level, though, and you become aware of the pub's unique character. The blackboard reads, "The English pub at its unspoilt best. Opening times, if we are open, we are open. If we are closed, we are closed. No chips, no fry-ups, no UHT milk, no silly foil portions, no children, no plastic playground or music machines or big screens. Plenty good food, real ale, good wine. Family hostile." This seemed slightly cranky and unfriendly at first. For one thing, no chips is just snobbery. If they're good enough for Nigel Slater in the bistros of Paris, they're good enough for a pub in Chester. But after half an hour inside, I was willing to forgive them anything. You could say that the pub is themed, though I'd say it when the landlord isn't listening. Themed usually means decked out as a Bondi Beach surf shack or festooned with agricultural implements in a poor approximation of a Connemara saloon bar. But not here. The Albion Inn just hasn't changed much since 1915. There are adverts for Fry's chocolate, cast iron fireplaces, William Morris wallpaper, and tasteful reminders everywhere of the Cheshire Regiment and the young lads who may have drunk a pint here after enlisting at the nearby drill hall, oblivious of the horrors to come. All was peaceful that afternoon, though, as I sat in the dappled sun, drinking my pint of real ale, leafing through a guidebook, and tucking into my Tunstall tortilla, black pudding, cheese and onion in a Staffordshire oatcake. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was hard to leave the Albion Inn, but I did. I had to. I got a phone call from a radio producer friend telling me that a nice man from a bookshop in Chester had rung the BBC to say that I'd left my credit card there. And so I walked the whole circuit of the walls again, back to Gildas Books, slightly slower this time thanks to the added cargo of tortilla and beer. When I was a child, I thought Wigan was a spa town. I thought this because we had a branch of spa. I got my Beezer comic and my Opal fruits there. Later, I learned that a spa town was something altogether grander, and that Wigan certainly wasn't one, but that Cheltenham, Bath, Epsom, Tunbridge Wells and Harrogate are. But for the discovery of a chalybeate well in the late 16th century, Harrogate would have no greater of opinion of itself than Hunslet, Hull or many another Yorkshire town. But as the fame of its healing waters spread, Harrogate prospered into the genteel, elegant, enormously pleased with itself place that it is today. Its streets are wide and tree-lined, its houses Georgian and breathtakingly expensive for these parts, and its hotels seem the sort of places where the linen is always starched, the waiters gouty, and breakfast finishes at 8. Maybe I didn't give it a chance, but I didn't really warm to Harrogate. Part tourist trap, part dormitory town, unwarrantedly snobby. It was neither micklin nor mucklin, as Billy Lyre might say in his cod Yorkshire patois. This really was fur coat and no knickers territory. Walking up the steep drag behind the famous Royal Baths, you'll find those twee little shops that sell gollywogs and scented soap, jostling for position next to dodgy nightclubs and a long defunct pizzeria with smeared windows and a filthy facade. Harrogate, I mused, is a bit like a Georgette Heyer heroine with a bottle of Alka-Pops shoved down her petticoat. She fancies herself, but she's not as classy as she thinks she is. If you do drink from the famous old sulphur well at the pump room, known as the Stinking Well and reputedly the most sulphurous well in the world, the trick is to hold your nose. You might be able to get it down if you don't actually smell it. Better still, the trick is to avoid it completely. Until the coming of the pump room, the waters used to be dispensed by one Betty Lupton, octogenarian Queen of the Wells. Betty has long gone, but she gives her name to a famous Harrogate landmark, Betty's Tea Rooms. Betty's is as much about old-world ambience as the menu. You can have a live Mozart piano trio with your rarebit, although the nosh is very good and is described enticingly as Swiss Yorkshire. An under-publicised fusion cuisine, this, but I can recommend it. Though it will never be anything as vulgar as a franchise, there are 6 Betty's branches now, although the family firm has steadfastly refused to open any outside God's own county. Very Yorkshire, that. There's one down the road in Ilkley, a lovely little town which is in its own way just as classy as Harrogate, but more subtly so, and definitely shyer about saying as much. Ilkley folk seem to want to keep the place to themselves. I don't blame them. However, having the world's most famous moor somewhat stymies them in this regard. It brings in their bank holiday droves, the day trippers, the tourers, and the ramblers in their coaches and cars. It brought me too, ambling up the gentle slopes and through the bracken. If you're used to Penny Gent in the Dales or the High Fells of Cumbria, Ilkley Moor is a hands-in-pocket stroll along well-marked paths. But there's a lot up there to recommend it. It's quite wild and woolly, littered with rocks, thrown around by a local giant after a tiff with the missus, so legend has it, and it has one genuinely weird and compelling place. This is known as the Swastika Stone. There, in its own little enclosure, high on the moor, is an ancient carving that looks like the Nazi emblem done by some really stoned hippies. The unmistakable configuration, but done in soft, round, blurry curves like a Grateful Dead cover. It's been here since a millennium and a half before Christ. And from it, you can see the Pennines range away into the misty distance. But what's it for? No one's really sure, to be honest. Some think it's sun worship, some think it's a fertility symbol. A friend who knows about these things feels they're a lot less mystical and esoteric than we think. It's probably a bit of graffiti by a Pict who'd drunk too much fermented birch sap. Dartmoor, Bodmin Moor and Exmoor might dispute my claim about Ilkley being the world's most famous moor, but think about it. Do they have their own theme song? On Ilkley Moor Bart At is sung lustily by Yorkshiremen everywhere and by the Yorkshire diaspora around the globe. It's sung by non-Yorkshiremen everywhere too, usually without understanding a word of it. Essentially, it's a meditation on mortality and the cyclical nature of existence prompted by a bloke going for a walk with his girlfriend on the moor. Said bloke does this without a hat, Bart At, which prompts the unnamed narrator to speculate that such behaviour will result in his catching a cold and subsequent death. From pneumonia, I imagine. But the cheery morbidity doesn't stop there. Then, says the sinister narrator, we'll have to bury you and the worms will eat you. They, in turn, will be eaten by ducks. Ducks on a moor, let it pass. But in an ending that will please Buddhists, the ducks will be eaten by humans and the great wheel of life will continue to turn. Invigorated by the strong wind and feeling reckless and hatless, I sang a verse or two as I strolled along. A doughty rambler who I hadn't seen emerged from behind a tree and gave me a look as if to say, "They all do that, you know." If the swastika stone didn't convince you that underneath the doilies and the dainties, Ilkley, like much of the north, has stuff that is old and dark and weird, then pop into the church. There's a saint with the head of a bull, a variety of phallic symbols, two Roman altars with runnels to carry away the blood after live sacrifices, and what is thought to be a carving of the water goddess Verbea, clutching two very primordial-looking serpents. It's a long way from the Vicar of Dibley. So, in Harrogate, Ilkley, and their, ilk, the North has its Cheltenhams, Marlboroughs and Leamingtons, slightly faded, prone to tears after a few G&Ts, but with a lot of class and still a hell of a looker. And in the Golden Triangle of Cheshire, it has its Cannes and Nice, suntans, beautiful people, yacht showrooms. But does it have its Islingtons, its Hampsteads, its Hoxtons, its Bohemian enclaves, what the Americans would call its crunchy granola belt? The answer is yes, and not far from Ilkley, actually. If Yorkshire is Texas, then Hebden Bridge is its Austin, hidden in the hills, a groovy outpost of liberal hippie cool in the middle of redneck cowboy country. It all began in the late 1960s when the unassuming mill village of Hebden Bridge went into the same seemingly terminal decline as its neighbouring Pennine textile towns. The former workers fled to find jobs elsewhere, and Hebden Bridge slumped. At one point in the 70s, there was talk of terraced houses changing hands for the price of a good night out. Whole streets were demolished. But as the mill workers deserted Hebden, impoverished hippies from everywhere heard that here, and ripe for settling, was a lovely town set in a beautiful landscape with artistic connections. Bronteland is over the hill in Howarth. Ted Hughes was born 2 miles away in Mythemroyd, and Sylvia Plath is buried on a hill overlooking Hebden. Word got around that you could squat in real stone cottages and sturdy artisans' terraces, grow your hair and grow your own without too much hassle. The hippies told their friends. They came, they saw, they set up juggling shops and whole food delis, and over 3 decades Hebden Bridge has blossomed into what's been called the Hampstead of the North. The tolerant atmosphere has made it the lesbian capital of Britain, ladies of sapphic tastes outnumbering their hetero sisters by 6 to 1, it's said, which has led the arguably local and definitely unhinged Bernard Ingham to call it tantamount to Sodom and Gomorrah. If you arrive by train and you're a romantic, you'll do a bit of billing and cooing over the cute little station. You'll feel sure you've just seen Trevor Howard helping Celia Johnson get something out of her eye. Although, actually, the real brief encounter station is Carnforth in Lancashire. Out of the station, then, you're into Hebden itself, a relaxed, vibrant, pretty little town that's a riot of antiquarian bookshops and organic delis, if you can have a riot of such things, a vigil, perhaps. One local resident, a writer called John Morrison, began to gently parody the town's achingly liberal credentials in a series of online columns that grew into 3 books. View from the Bridge, Back to the Bridge, and A Bridge Too Far. He writes about recognisable local archetypes, such as Willow Woman, a befuddled tree hugger, and Wounded Man. Not gay exactly, but happy to pitch in if they were ever short-handed. Wounded Man is a founder member of the Holistic Plumbers Collective, who try to put plumbing problems into a more global context. Instead of just mending leaks or plumbing in washing machines, they like to sit around at the customer's house, drinking coffee and consulting the I Ching. Only when they have fully explored their feelings do they make any effort to get down to work, by which point, in an unconscious homage to more conventional plumbing procedures, they usually find they've forgotten to bring any tools with them. In a bitter reversal of the 60s trend that made Hebden what it is, house prices are now spiralling and some fear the town is becoming a dormitory for the yuppies of Leeds and Manchester. Local activists are resisting this, though. One of them, Susan Quick, says, We refuse to contemplate the possibility of becoming a rich commuter belt and losing the very thing that makes Hebden what it is, all those weird and funny people who can afford to live here and do their own thing, the eccentrics, the offbeats and the dropouts. Pippin and Sorrel and all the other children of that first hippie generation can't afford to live here now where they were born. 2 years ago, they took over Hebden's vacant tourist information centre, a site earmarked for redevelopment, and set up the People's Information Centre. Though their plight is not uncommon, you can't help wishing them well. Hebden Bridge is that rarity, a small town without small-mindedness. It would be sad if it lost its unique, heady aroma, but it may be already happening. John Morrison says that nowadays, if you see somebody mumbling a mantra, it's probably the FT100 share index. Morrison himself has left town now, sold up and gone to the fleshpots of the Lake District. We're leaving Hebden Bridge too. Having told you that the North can be every bit as she-she, funky and bleeding edge as your moneyed South, we now step into a different picture. Put your head through this hole, madam, and find yourself in a saucy postcard, where a diminutive, balding man with a red face and an undernourished leek is having an amusing misunderstanding about sexual organs with a huge lady in a floral print dress. In the background, you can just make out a teenage girl in a Stetson vomiting on the log flume. Just smell that bladder rack, wee and stale Tetleys. I do like to be beside the seaside. I don't remember anything before Blackpool. A lot of people have probably said that, as they lie in intensive care waiting for the stomach pump, but what I mean is that Blackpool is one of my earliest memories. Working class Lancastrians go, or at least went, to Blackpool so often, and so regularly, for day trips, holidays, stag do's, that it's impossible to date accurately when my first trip was. The mid-60s, I imagine, probably in a romper suit and on reins, always being likely to stray under a passing tram to Cleveley's. But I guess that I must have been there 3 or 4 or 5 times a year for the first dozen or so years of my life. In that, I was by no means unusual. Different towns, in Lancashire and in Scotland, would have different holiday periods or wakes weeks in which the factories would close for a fortnight and the town would pretty much decamp to Blackpool. Preston would have certain weeks, Blackburn others. Wigan's weeks were the same as Glasgow's, which made for a lively old time, I can tell you. Factor in countless day trips, and all Lancastrians and most Scots of a certain socio-economic group got to know Blackpool as well as their own hometown. In the last couple of decades, I've hardly been back at all. So for the first time in years, I find myself on this chilly, drizzly spring morning aboard a packed Northern train sprinter service from Preston to Blackpool North. In its own way, the train and its passengers were as queer and colourful as a trip to the hill station at Darjeeling or overnighting on the Trans-Siberian Express. It was a kind of carnival on wheels. Less charitably, some might have called it a travelling freak show. Though, maybe, I was the freak. When I took a book out and began to read, the whole carriage looked at me as if I'd taken out a cuckoo clock or a lacrosse stick. There were entire families who appeared to be in fancy dress. Surely that's not what they wore normally. Stetsons, gold lamé tracksuits, helmets with horns, replica football kits. It was a kind of uniform. They were dressed for fun. They had planned for fun, with military precision, and every shred of their being was focused on its acquisition. I found that quite sweet, but this early, on a nippy morning, on a grubby train, it was also kind of tough on the nerves. Everyone, young and old, was shouting. Some were arguing, some were demanding attention, some were shouting merely from the sheer, unalloyed joy of being on a train to Blackpool. One man had a toy rifle. Two Asian girls were dancing to cheesy dance music from a radio on the table. There was a shy-looking girl holding a giant, furry prawn over her shoulder. After all this, Blackpool North was a deadening experience. It looked less like a railway station than a decontamination plant. If this were your first time in Blackpool on the first day of a long-awaited holiday, you must surely wish you'd booked for somewhere else. A disused naval base in the Bering Straits, perhaps. Blackpool, I'd been told, has a large transient population and a big drugs problem. Everywhere there were signs telling me what would happen if I were caught taking crystal meth by the booking office or whatever. The gent's toilet was like a vision of hell lit with a sickly and unreal deep vermilion. This is anti-drug lighting, so called because you can't find a vein to hit in this light. Or maybe because everything looks so weird and disorienting that you decide you don't need any more drugs anyway. But get out of the station and head down Talbot Road and things get better. After a few hundred Poundlands, a couple of branches of Greggs and several discount bookshops, I spotted the North Pier. It could have been the big kid in me or the race memory of the Northerner, but suddenly my heart lifted and my step quickened. I was 9 again. The sun came out. The amusement arcade beckoned. I had a pocket full of change, and when it ran out, I didn't have to ask my dad for more. Bliss. Freedom. I'm glad to report that amusement arcades haven't changed that much in 30 years. Yes, there are huge, terrifying-looking machines that you have to be strapped into like a Navy SEAL into a stealth fighter, and where you attempt to eliminate the Vorgon race at unbelievable volumes. Yes, there are virtual reality games where cadaverous, life-size zombies try to sever your head with a rusty scythe. But if you look hard enough, you will find the treasures of your childhood and fall on them with fetishistic pleasure. There are still the penny falls, which are now 10 pence, obviously, but still as blatantly fixed as ever, teetering piles of coins, never quite cascading over the lip, perhaps due to the gobbets of superglue keeping them in place. There is still a Perspex box where you can signally fail to get a grabbing hand to ensnare some kind of gift. Once upon a time I seem to recall that this was 20 B&H or some kind of rubbish Swiss watch, but now it's a disfigured gonk. It doesn't matter. It's not the prize. It's the tantalising Sisyphean swing of the grabber that lures us, a lesson in the ultimate futility of desire. Fish and chips on the prom sounded a cheering idea, and so it proved to be. My fish was bought from a man who seemed to have arrived that morning from Uzbekistan, so dark and phlegmy was his pronunciation of haddock. It was without doubt the fishiest fish I have ever tasted. It tasted rankly and pungently of the sea, which at Blackpool is not always a good idea. Feeling a bit weak, I sat in a bus shelter and marvelled at an advert for an afternoon performance by Charlie Caroli. Surely not the same one who blighted my Easter Mondays with his sinister, unfunny routines on Billy Smart's circus. He must be 100 years old by now. It has to be his son. Maybe his grandson. Maybe a virtual reality hologram. Caroli Jr. was appearing at Blackpool's famous tower, which, as you probably know, is a scale model of the Eiffel Tower. I'd tell you more about this fine landmark structure and its attractions, but it was £12.50 to get in, so sod that, I thought. Instead, I decided I would spend my money on something that I've always fancied, but never done, something which has haunted my imagination since I were a child, something a little naughty, wicked even, that my grandma would have shuddered at and ushered me by with alacrity. Romany Pearl is one of a score of gypsy fortune tellers plying their trade along the Golden Mile. I don't know why I chose her. There were more salubrious, even some quite flashy-looking fortune tellers on offer. But I picked Romany Pearl's place, accessed directly off the prom through a little curtain next door to a burger bar. In a room the size of a telephone box, with a little half-door over which you can look out onto the street, sits Pearl, a woman with a deep, leathery tan and a baritone acquired by a lifetime of Embassy Regal. She sits like the Sphinx. The Sphinx with cerise talons and bangles and black candy floss for hair. She may be pushing 60, but if you told me she was 90, I'd believe you. I went for palms, not tarot. "One hand or both?" asked Romany. "What's the difference?" I asked. 2, she said, gives a deeper reading. And, crucially, it cost a tenner rather than a fiver. Feeling giddy, I opted for the full £10 and both hands. "You've always been lucky," Pearl tells me in a voice like sifting gravel. "If you fell in the canal in your old suit, you'd come up in a new one, and you'll never want for money." Great. Also, I'm not going to die of a disease, apparently, but of old age. I nearly say that, strictly speaking, you could say that's a disease. I think better of it, in case she changes her prediction to, "You're going to be beaten to death by an irate gypsy of indeterminate age." She tells me that in a month's time, I'm going to have a really big surprise. A happy one, but a really big one all the same. Well, the month has gone, and I'm still waiting, but I'll keep you informed. As I leave, Romany Pearl asks if I want to buy a lucky charm. "I don't need it, do I?" I laugh at what I think is quite a smart remark. Romany Pearl doesn't seem to get it. Along the crowded front, most of the hotel names I remember from childhood are still here. The Craigie Don, the Balmoral, the Gainsborough. The Lindine offers, implausibly, a 5-course dinner for £8.95. I'm seeing all this from the window of a tram, the only way to travel in Blackpool, except for donkey, of course, and I'm en route to the Pleasure Beach, where I haven't been in donkey's years. I'm feeling a little bit sick. It could be long-dormant excitement, or it could be the fish. The Pleasure Beach is a huge amusement park at the southern end of the Golden Mile. It's Blackpool's Coney Island. You can't go to Blackpool and not go to the Pleasure Beach. It'd be like going to Mount Rushmore and saying, "Oh, well, we didn't bother with that big carved mountainside faces thing. We just had a look in the gift shop." You have to pass through a metal detector to get into the Pleasure Beach now. Sad, isn't it? But before I lapse into full damning indictment of our troubled society mode, I should say that fairgrounds have always hung heavy with latent violence. Remember Albert Finney getting duffed up by those squaddies in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning? This simmering threat of trouble, mingled with a little illicit sex and the hugely amplified sound of the sweet ballroom blitz from the waltzer, is what has always made them so intoxicating to me. One of my favourite photographs ever is found on the back of the Smiths' The World Won't Listen album. It shows four teenage girls, circa 1964, hair piled high, faces beautiful and feral, resplendent in their best Rita Tushingham finery on the platform at the side of the waltzer. It is just perfect. The Pleasure Beach these days promises a more corporate and familial day out. Thanks to the metal detector, I never feel that a teddy boy will razor me at any point. It's £29 for a wristband that entitles you to ride the 145 attractions all day. If that's not enough, you can even stay here at the chic, modern, Big Blue Hotel, where each child's bunk bed has its own built-in TV to put an end to fighting for the remote control. In amongst all this slick innovation, the Pleasure Beach still has much of the trashy, dangerous flavour that made it so thrilling to the youthful Marconi. The whole place is a cacophony of competing barkers, each trying to antagonise slightly drunk men into securing their girlfriends a cuddly toy by throwing darts, knocking coconuts off stands, or shooting pop guns. One is a kind of basketball thing in which the prize for a hoop is a giant furry prawn. I can't fathom the basketball crustacean connection, but it at least explains where the girl on the train got hers from. To the dismay of my health-conscious friends, another thing I love about fairgrounds is what the Americans call fair food. While I yield to no man in my admiration for a nice truffle oil risotto with a parmesan and beetroot foam, there are times when only a Westler's lung burger eaten outside a van will do. It helps, of course, if you're quite drunk. I wasn't, but I still couldn't resist the dark, savoury, intoxicating odour of fried onions wafting over the park. Be honest, can anyone? The Pleasure Beach, I'm quoting again, has over 35 restaurants and cafes offering an amazing choice of food, from pasta and pizza at the Italian Job to a burger at the largest Burger King restaurant in the UK. I did, though, spot a worrying trend towards culinary gentrification, with several outlets openly offering skinny decaf lattes and focaccia. And what's that over 35 supposed to mean? Do they mean 36? Morecambe was once a rival to Blackpool in the popularity stakes. Then, like New Brighton on the Wirral, it became a byword for faded glamour and slow decline. In 1994, Noel Edmonds opened his ill-judged, insane if you ask me, World of Crinkly Bottom in Morecambe, a theme park based on his reviled but hugely popular Saturday tea time show, Noel's House Party. Much in evidence was Mr. Blobby, a hyperthyroidal, psychedelic PVC monster, alongside which Barney the Purple Dinosaur had gravitas and quiet authority. In a rare but gratifying show of taste, the British public stayed away in their droves, and it closed after 13 weeks, although the ensuing Blobbygate legal wrangle between Lancaster City Council and Edmonds went on for some time. Not long afterwards, Morecambe's indoor water park Bubbles closed, closely followed by Frontierland, its pleasure beach. The west end of Morecambe became a slum in effect, the hotels used as DHSS hostels as house prices tumbled. The grisly, well-publicised deaths of 23 Chinese cockle pickers on the bay's treacherous sands didn't exactly act as a boost to tourism either. Lately, though, Morecambe has shown signs of a recovery. That self-same dilapidated West End is becoming a desirable address, and property prices are on the up. There's a massive redevelopment programme underway, and the tourist board are working hard to sell the area by emphasising its gorgeous, if lethal, bay and its closeness to the Lake District. To be honest, this is a bit like Hull selling itself on its proximity to the Yorkshire Dales, but they mean well. And on a clear day, the hills of Cumbria, seen across the glittering water, do seem both very spectacular and very near. The Lake District occupies a very special part of the North's actual and psychological landscape. Like Blackpool, every northerner goes there at some point. In fact, probably as an antidote to Blackpool. That big, blousy tourist trap is really only a few miles south down the coast. The lakes, though, despite Jimmy McGovern's best efforts to paint them as a maelstrom of forbidden lust and telegenically unresolved issues in his TV drama of the same name, remain somehow aloof from the strident shore of Lanky to the south. If Blackpool is the Northwest's hyperactive huckster superego, then the Lake District is its deep-lying spiritual subconscious. The Lake District is, at least in theory, everything that Blackpool is not. Blackpool is chip fat and sodium lights. The lakes is crystalline air and twinkling stars. Blackpool is fizzy keg lager, the crash of slot machines and Robbie Williams. The lakes is real ale, birdsong and Wordsworth. Blackpool is sluttishly demeaning. The lakes is dreamily uplifting. In theory, anyway. Bowness has become as tasteless as the carling that flows in gallons there every weekend, a nasty fragment of Blackpool relocated by a once beautiful lake, now a playground for permatan tossers with powerboats and jet skis. Because of its proximity to big industrial cities like Sheffield and Manchester, the Peak District has always been more of a workers' playground than the lakes. You can be on the foothills of Kinder Scout and the Dark Peak in 40 minutes from dense city estates and suburbs. So there's a long tradition of factory workers hiking out there on their Sundays off, forming societies, cycling and tramping and fell walking, and, as they walked and talked, maybe wondering why some of this beautiful landscape was closed to them, fermenting radical thoughts, and eventually and famously trespassing on Kinder Scout in 1932, an act as much to do with class struggle as calisthenics. Out of this came the Ramblers Society, of whom the lazy stereotype is a cuddly sinecure for geriatrics, when in fact its true spirit is far more radical and bolshy than any of those Westminster village idiots. Lakeland's flash of red, though, was more likely to be seen on a huntsman's coat than a worker's flag. When Northwesterners get high ideas, in every sense, they head for Cumbria, as this chunk of Northwest England has been called since 1974. The newish nomenclature has stuck well, really. It's used reasonably naturally in most people's daily speech, as well as more official usages, like the BBC's local radio station and local government circles. This may be because the name has a good, solid pedigree. Cumbria, sometimes Reged, was the name given by the Celts to the kingdom that flourished here between the fall of the Romans and the coming of the Anglo-Saxons. Before Cumbria came into being for a second time, the Lake District as a concept, later enshrined as a national park, loosely spanned three counties, Westmorland, Cumberland and Lancashire. Yes, Lancashire, one of the iconic Lake District mountains, the Old Man of Coniston, as well as Coniston Water and several fine hills, valleys and tarns, lay squarely in North Lancashire. A fact I brandish like a pitchfork whenever someone accuses me of being an offcomer or an interloper. Westmorland sits between Lancashire, Yorkshire, County Durham and Cumberland and claims most of the well-known beauty spots, while Cumberland, which will tell you over a pint of Jennings that it's the real Cumbria, curves around the north of the district and has its most unspoilt tracts. There is a faint but readily discernible rivalry and suspicion between these different Cumbrians. I once tried to buy a particular knitted garment, a gift for an elderly relative, in the Edinburgh Woolen Mill in Penrith. Oh, we don't stock that. Try our branch in Keswick. It's more geared for tourists, said the county set lady with a haughty toss of her silver rinse, as if Keswick were Las Vegas and I'd asked for a pair of crotchless panties rather than a nice cable-knit cardi. The place where all three counties meet is called the Three Shires Stone, a slender rock pillar sitting high above the Rhino's Pass in the heart of the hills and a favourite walker's haunt. Here, at dusk, you will always find a damp, dishevelled man or woman tugging their sodden socks off, perched on the boot lip of their muddy estate car and eating the mangled remains of what seems to have become a pork pie and banana sandwich due to rough carriage in a rucksack and drinking hot Nescafe from a thermos. Bliss. The first tourists did it in rather more style, in frock coats and bumping around in stagecoaches, looking at the mountains backwards through bijou handheld mirrors because, bless, they were too frightened to look directly at them. They had been inspired by the romantic poets who decamped here in the early part of the 19th century. The lake poets were hardier souls than those first perfumed, salt-smelling, shrinking violets of tourists, I'm glad to say. They could certainly hold their laudanum, and Coleridge, the best and boldest of the lot, made the first recorded ascent of Scafell Pike, England's highest mountain, in the dark, without an anorak, a century and a half too early, sadly, but with a quill pen and a writing desk. Read his account. It's utterly thrilling. He would also think nothing of walking the 13 or so miles over Dunmail Raes from Keswick to Grasmere to see his mates, the Wordsworths. Dorothy W. would walk halfway back with him at night, and I'm pretty sure that Coleridge used this time profitably in trying to put his hand up Dot's skirt, but clearly I can't be definitively sure. Wordsworth, an altogether more boring fellow in his middle age, skulked around at home, perhaps writing one of his 32 sonnets about the River Duddon. I love Wordsworth, and he is a genuine poetic revolutionary, but he wrote too much, and he was woefully inconsistent. The preludes and the lyrical ballads changed English poetry forever, but he could also come up with this clunker in The Thorn, the best example of bathos I know. And to the left, 3 yards beyond, you see a little muddy pond, of water never dry. I've measured it from side to side. 'Tis 3 feet long and 2 feet wide. For me, the quintessential Lake District writer isn't one of those opiated and dissolute romantics, geniuses though they were, but a squat bloke from Blackburn who seemingly wore the same anorak for 20 years. Alfred Wainwright, the blessed A.W., as some but not all of the walking fraternity refer to him, came with his cousin to Windermere in 1930 and climbed Orrest Head, overlooking the district's largest lake on its eastern shore. It was love at first sight. Those few hours on Orrest Head cast a spell that changed my life, he later wrote. He devoted the rest of his life to walking and writing about the Lake District Fells, taking a pay cut in order to become borough treasurer in Kendal, and thus closer to the landscape that had ensnared him. He was a good borough treasurer by all accounts, stolid, a little frightening, genial enough in his old-fashioned way. But he lived a double life. For 13 years, he spent every non-working hour composing, setting, drawing, and writing by hand the 7-volume study of the Lake District Mountains that are his masterpiece, and for me, one of the great works of English literature. They are truly beautiful things, recognisably and obviously stunning, even if you've no interest at all in the Lake District. Passion, care and attention to detail ring out from every hand-measured indentation to every pencilled hatching on every cliff face. As Hunter Davis once put it, not merely guidebooks, but philosophical strolls, personal outpourings of feelings and observations written and drawn by a craftsman conceived and created as a total work of art. Wainwright himself called them love letters, and because of that, he refused to take money for them, giving it instead, well over $1 million, to an animal rescue centre. But Wainwright was a complicated man, and my relationship with him is just as complicated. In his early work, Pennine Journey, he is worryingly ambivalent about Hitler, and if anything, he moved rightward as he aged. Some of his often silly and sometimes disturbingly illiberal views are lauded as old-fashioned common sense by cultees. But not me. It's Wainwright the lover, not Wainwright the political philosopher I warm to. I'd rather remember him as the man who could write, "The fleeting hour of life of those who love the hills is quickly spent, but the hills are eternal. Always there will be the lonely ridge, the dancing beck, the silent forest. Always there will be the exhilaration of the summits." The lakes may be as overexposed as, well, insert name of currently ubiquitous celebrity here if you don't mind doing that bit of work yourself, thanks. But the Cumbrian coast is an enigma. I know it pretty well because of my enthusiasm for the county and its landscapes, but most people, most northerners even, don't know it at all. The biggest town on this coast was a real mystery even to me. No one I asked had ever been there, even though at one point it was an industrial powerhouse, a huge naval and shipbuilding centre which attracted workers from all across Britain and the world. Now the world thinks of it as isolated, insular and partly abandoned, a hulking town cut off from the mainstream of life at the end of a peninsula where few ever venture. A place that even the locals refer to, thanks to an old Mike Harding routine, as stuck at the end of the A590, the longest cul-de-sac in Britain. Barrow-in-Furness is a bloody long way from anywhere. An hour from the nearest motorway, even further from the nearest city. That's a long way for Britain. Like Iran, this part of the northern coast was once a theocracy. During the Middle Ages, it was ruled by the powerful monks of Furness Abbey, just outside modern Barrow. Back then, this little fishing hamlet really was cut off, surrounded on three sides by water or the dangerous sands of the Duddon estuary, and on the other, pinned against the sea by the high fells of the Lake District. These days, Barrow has adopted "Where the mountains meet the sea" as a dreamy marketing slogan, gamely trying to make a virtue of what was once a curse. Then in 1846, usual story, the Furness Railway was opened, connecting Barrow to the national network at Fleetwood, and the town boomed. Iron and steel brought prosperity, and the population mushroomed. The architect of modern Barrow was one James Ramsden of the Furness Railway Company, who seems to have run the town almost as a fiefdom, owning the town hall, the railway, streets worth of houses, and sitting unopposed as mayor for years. Ramsden oversaw the building of the docks and the founding of Ramsden's Barrow Shipbuilding Company, which became Vickers in 1897. Through a turbulent 20th century, war brought Barrow prosperity, while it brought other cities hell. Barrow built the Mikasa, the Japanese flagship of the Russo-Japanese War, and the aircraft carrier HMS Invincible, and a fleet of other floating widowmakers. Later, Barrow became synonymous with submarines. The Royal Navy's first one, Holland One, was built here in 1901, and newer ones, such as HMS Resolution, were developed in the 1960s. The Vanguard-class submarines were all built in Barrow. Beneath the inky waters of the world's oceans, cold warriors crisscrossed the globe in Barrow-built, sleek and deadly nuclear subs. They were never used in anger, thank God. The thaw at the end of the Cold War might have warmed most of us, but it brought a chill to Barrow. There were over 20,000 workers at the shipyard at the start of the 1980s. There were just 3,000 in the year 2000. Barrow hasn't had much in the way of good press these last 20 years, and to cap it all, in 2002, it had the grim distinction of suffering the UK's worst outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. 7 people died, and another 172 people got sick, thanks to a faulty air conditioning duct at the town's arts centre. This might have put me in a downcast frame of mind as I made my way along that famous cul-de-sac, the A590, past Newby Bridge, Broughton and Ulverston, birthplace of Stan Laurel. But I was in a good mood. The sun was shining, the hills were green and sparkling. I had never been to Barrow before, and I like adventures, however small. Besides, who can fail to have their spirits lifted by a herd of pink rhinoceroses and elephants pootling along by the side of a major arterial road? The South Lakes Animal Park was the brainchild of an animal nutritionist called David Gill, who runs a similar venture in Australia. You'll see him wandering around the park in a bush hat. From scratch, and in an engagingly cranky homemade fashion, he's built what's generally regarded as Britain's best conservation park. A haven for wildlife from around the globe, and undoubtedly the only place in the northwest where you're likely to spot a Hamadryas baboon, or a pygmy hippo, or Sumatran tiger, or marmoset from the window of your Mondeo as you negotiate a roundabout. Entering Barrow now, once you've got over the shock of the grazing pachyderms by the hard shoulder, you're struck by the contrasts. Wide, handsome streets and a majestic sandstone town hall alternate with the ubiquitous trappings of urban northern blight. The golden megatan with its promise of 180-watt sunbeds, the branches of Greggs, of course, and the drab pubs, of which Healy's looks like a maximum security prison with its steel shutters and dearth of windows. If you visit Barrow's Dock Museum, and I really recommend you do, you'll find it is really rather classily done. Beautiful scale models of ocean liners remind you that Barrow didn't just make warships and trident subs, but stylish state-of-the-art floating hotels for the world's leisured elite. Many Barrovians can remember the dates of every big launch. They were red-letter days in the town, and the kids were given the day off school. Leaving the museum and walking along the waterfront, a rather quaint little mess of boats and netting in the shadow of the enormous BAE submarine yard, you are at once buffeted by Barrow's legendary local winds. At Christmas 1929, a wind of 115 miles an hour shook the town. Barrow's breeziness is enshrined in an old joke. Two men meet on a still, silent day in the middle of the desert. Both have their hands on their hats. One says to the other, "I sees that's from Barrow as well." When the shipyards and steel mills laid people off, thousands of Barrow's workers went up the road in search of work. Literally, up the very road I'm on now, and I have to tell you, this is a fabulous way to get to the office. As the road and, hopefully, the car hug the contours of the high shoreline, you'll see on your right that the spoil heaps are grassing over and turning green. On your left, though, is a panorama that will stop you mid-suck on your merriment and have your nervous passenger grabbing the wheel and turning your slack jaw to face the road. The sea fills the low sky westward, and a glittering serpentine arm insinuates its way up the warm, muddy thighs of the Duddon Sands. Behind it is the vast, well-backed bulk of Black Coombe, forgotten giant of the Cumbrian Mountains, where you'll walk all day and never see a soul. But your eye is drawn now beyond Black Coombe to the distant splendour of the high fells of the Southern Lakes, a vast, rumpled duvet of smudgy, blue, retreating ridges lit by a watery sun. As a commute, it beats the Circle Line, even if, some would say, you're off to stoke the pits of hell. I remember a broadsheet cartoon from the mid-80s that made me chuckle. It was just after the Chernobyl disaster, when the story was doing the rounds that Soviet nuclear power chiefs had asked Britain's advice in dealing with the devastated plant. Two white-coated British boffins are reporting back, and one is saying, "We've suggested that they change the name." The sign on the door reads Sellafield. The joke being that the world's oldest commercial nuclear power plant began life as Calder Hall. It has bits called Magnox and Thorpe, and it changed the name of its main site from Windscale to Sellafield in 1981. Okay, so strictly, the names applied to different sections. But it all added to a perception that there was something sordid and shameful about the place, like a cheap con man with a roll call of aliases. Environmentalists and Irish pop stars have a very poor opinion of Sellafield. They say it has become a dumping ground for the world's nuclear waste, which is true, even if British Nuclear Fuels Limited dress it up as a reprocessing facility. That waste, by the way, has to be kept away from people for 250,000 years, 50 times longer than the history of the written word. That's a long time. They also say that it accounts for the abnormally high rates of childhood leukemia along this coast, although British Nuclear Fuels Limited dispute this. They say that it pumps radioactive waste into the Irish Sea, which certainly was true, although arguably much less so today. They say that it can't be justified on the grounds of producing clean, non-fossil fuel energy, because it doesn't. They're right, it ceased being a power plant in 2003. They say it's a target for a terrorist attack and an accident waiting to happen. That may be the case, although that would also apply to most airports, chemical plants and gasometers. There's no two ways about it, though. However gung-ho you are about the place, you'd definitely be happier having a nice cake shop at the bottom of your garden. The trouble is that when West Cumbria fell on hard times, there just weren't enough cake shops looking to take on staff. Sellafield offered a lifeline to devastated communities. It employs 12,000 people in the region, and its benefits extend further than this, boosting local service industries and infrastructure. A few years back, I stayed at a very good country house hotel not far inland from the plant, nestling by the shores of England's deepest lake, the vast and gloomy Wastwater. On a Monday night, the place was respectably full with smart professional types, clearly not holidaymakers, chatting discreetly over the amuse-bouche. The next day, I asked the proprietor what brought these sober industrialists in steel-rimmed specs to Nether Wasdall. Sellafield was the answer. We couldn't survive without it. Sellafield doesn't have to convince most West Cumbrians of its importance to their survival. Most will have a family member or a neighbour who either works there or whose job depends on it. But Sellafield knows it has an image problem. So over the last 20 years or so, it has doggedly fought the PR battle. You wouldn't exactly call it a charm offensive. They know they're never going to make it an ideal destination for that romantic mini-break. But they have at least tried to soften its image. There's an award-winning visitor centre, and on arrival at nearby Seascale Station on the forlorn coastal branch line that somehow survived Beeching's axe, you should find a couple of courtesy cars waiting to drive you to it. The centre is open every day of the year, but as I found, having snaked up the coast road behind a tractor, they do shut promptly at 5. I got to the massive car park with half an hour to spare, which the smartly dressed ladies in reception clearly didn't think would be enough to fully appreciate its many delights. But I insisted. I think on the whole, I was right. It's a very impressive place. Cavernous, ultra-modern and sexily lit, like a Bond villain's lair from which might come global destruction. Maybe not the best of looks for a nuclear plant, I suppose, but I was childishly taken by it. I half expected, and secretly rather wanted, to find the place nakedly and unashamedly partisan in its zeal for nuclear power. I looked in vain for giant figurines of Eileen the Isotope beaming her pale phosphorescence down on grateful kids, or for posters showing horribly polluted industrial towns where bronchial children wheezed while their mothers fought hand-to-hand over lumps of coal under a slogan reading, "Is this what you want? Because this is what will happen. Fossil fuel is for fossils. Embrace nuclear power or die." There was none of this. Sellafield is more politically correct, more wincingly guilt-ridden than a Guardian columnist defending her SUV and Umbrian holiday home. They even have a display devoted to the history of anti-nuclear protest. Yellow smiley-face badges saying, "Nuclear power? No thanks." Copies of Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Those scary Protect and Survive videos. And CND's response, "Protest and Survive." There isn't really a gift shop, but there are lots of feel-goody things that could be in a gift shop, or more accurately, a nursery. I have a theory, a faintly crabby one, I have to admit, that Britain has become a filiocracy. we are increasingly ruled by children in the sense that everything has to appeal to them or to those adults who think like them. Pretty much everything at Sellafield is presented in this way. There are leaflets saying, "Be a scientist for a day," featuring Dad and the kids with ridiculous Albert Einstein specs and moustache ensembles with their hair standing up. There's a sign advertising forthcoming events, obviously aimed at the little ones, that says, "Be a human bubble for a day." Personally, I think Sellafield's PR material should avoid anything that even hints at freakish mutations, but that's just my opinion. At 5, on the dot, I emerge from Sellafield into the deep, honeyed light of a late spring afternoon and head north and inland, away from the coast, through the towns of West Cumbria that depend on Sellafield. Egremont, home of Gurning, Cleeter Moor, where they once made Cangol hats, Frizzington, where Hunter Davis once asked a local what living there was like, and he replied, "Desperate." That was in the blighted 80s, though, and maybe life is better now. There are St. George's flags fluttering from windows in preparation for the World Cup. Some kids and a dog are playing football in the park, and the sun glints off a sign standing on the pavement outside the grocer's. I squint at it. It reads, "No pies today." Desperate indeed, and so I leave Cumbria on the Silk Cut Road to the Far East. Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. Am I a true northerner? I beg your pardon, Tarquin, perhaps you'd like to ask me that question again in the car park. I'm sure Sebastian here will hold your blazer and spritzer. Sorry, Red Mist, conforming to all regional stereotypes, I know, but the cheek. Am I a true northerner? Of course I am. I like pies. I am childishly pleased when Chelsea, Fulham and Arsenal lose. I say Bath and Kerr properly. I have my dinner at dinner time and my supper in my dressing gown. But in my quieter moments, when the fire is guttering and the last dram of the evening has slipped down, I am plagued by doubts. Dark memories return unbidden, and with them a sudden chill. It's the early 1980s, and I'm in the college bar one Friday night. My mate Stodd from Gateshead enters with two of his friends from home, who are visiting for the weekend. After introductions, one hands me a pint and cheerily engages me in conversation. Or rather, tries to. "Had a wee yuss and nuke brandy in the gannin one, Mara?" "Pardon? Ho wee the tabs bunny lad wore, Jackie Milburn?" "I'm sorry? Clark is so shills hinny wore high-level bridge down the netty pet?" Or something like that. It's like listening to a kind of Norse Doppler effect. Stretched vowels, random emphasis, and arcane dialect flow from his mouth and right over the top of my head. This is the sort of difficulty that an effete fop from Purley or Esher would have, but not a kindred spirit. Stodd notices my difficulty and starts to translate. All seem amused. I'm mortified, and I say so. After all, we're all northern brethren here. A small bout of genial scoffing ensues. "Now, bonny lad, dimna say you're from the north. You're from the Midlands, I read." Lancashire? The Midlands? But this is a cast of mind that these far northerners often take, Cumbrians, Teesiders and Geordies alike. Some even speak of the Great North, as in the Great North Road and the Great North Run. The Great North is England north of Yorkshire and Lancashire, which may look lonely, wild and empty in parts, but has a greater population than Wales. They will tell you that the northeast is the real England, that the very word England derives from land of the Angles, or the northeast. They will tell you that they are Vikings, and the rest of us are suburbanites. The northeast is the bit of the north that I don't really know. Basically, it's a long way away, one of the things that Philip Larkin loved about it and living there, and it's not on the way to anywhere except Berwick or Oslo via slow boat. If Larkin were alive today, he'd find that thanks to the staggeringly improved East Coast mainline, he could have breakfast in Hull and still make it to the capital for a bloody good lunch at Claridge's with Kingsley Amis. He probably wouldn't have bothered, though, and in that, he'd have a lot in common with his adopted kinsmen of the East. They loved that East Coast mainline, not for how quickly it can get them to London, but for how fast it gets them back to the northeast, back to its 2.5 million people, its 5 universities, 2 major ports, 2 international airports, and vibrant cities and towns including Darlington, Durham, Middlesbrough, Newcastle and Sunderland, all of which any self-respecting member of the North East Regional Development Council will tell you about at the drop of a massive Andy Capp-style cloth cap. But for all that they're fiercely proud of their region, Geordies don't display the bellicose mouthiness of the Manc or that garrulous overconfidence of the Scouser. This is why Geordies are the Southerner's favourite Northerner. They even sound lovely, while having by far and away the strangest